Welcome to Backlog Dialogues, the podcast that digs you out of your backlog before it buries you. I'm John, and joining me as always are two of my very good friends.
Who are definitely not planning to murder you.
Despite you dragging us along for this whole project for well over a year now.
Who are you?
It's good.
We're not doing this. This might be a new series for people. They might decide they want to jump in on the When They Cry series. Tell me your names right now.
I'm Matt.
I'm Jared.
Thank you. Hopefully we can keep that energy.
Dude, it wouldn't be representative of the show if I didn't give you a hard time here.
I understand that. And it wouldn't be representative of the show if I didn't ask you to say your names.
And it wouldn't be representative of the show if we didn't say the title. Good, we're all caught up.
This week we are bringing to you a brand new hype episode for a brand new series. That's right. We're getting ready for When They Cry.
In some ways, this series is the reason that this podcast exists, actually.
And you both said that about Kingdom Hearts, too.
Well, no, the actual reason was I wanted to get both of you to play Trails, but that's still down the road a bit. I got Matt like halfway through it.
My ridiculously circuitous plan is one third complete.
Yes, exactly.
Paraphrase for correct fractioning.
Yep. So let's talk about When They Cry. Like on the broad level, bird's eye view, thousand mile view, what are we even saying?
Elevator pitch, parking lot.
Yeah. Just let's talk about the author of When They Cry, first of all, Ryukishi 7.
I think before that, we should just say what is When They Cry.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
A series of visual sound novels and a multimedia project extending from those going back to, I want to say, 2002, and it's up through today.
Yep. I would probably best describe the vibe of these stories as blood and tear soaked tragedies.
You did plan the title with that, so you got to get it somewhere.
The reason I think people should care about When They Cry specifically is I would say that When They Cry is the postmodern fiction of our generation.
I'm sorry. I have such a hard time not laughing. Something of our generation.
No, I'm not even joking about that. It's just really
it does sound.
I'm not saying you are. The phrase just sounds funny. It's an inherently funny phrase.
I can go back on that. I can just say that it's
you don't have to. I'm just finding I just find the phrase funny. You don't have to change this because I'm ridiculous.
What I would say is that when I say a postmodern fiction, it's sometimes hard to say what I mean by that. But a lot of people will understand if you say, you know how some stories try to get meta about things? That's a symptom of it. But a lot of stories don't do it well. When They Cry does it really well.
I do kind of want to touch on that idea of postmodernism because there is this attitude as well of people of like, postmodernism has its head up its ass. And
it's very easy to do.
And if you try and pitch something as that, I think it might like turn people off.
Like Stephen King in his Dark Tower series put himself in the last book as one of the literal pillars of the universe and had his characters scold him about his 70s and 80s drug and alcohol habits. And that was
yeah. So When They Cry does not do that.
No, it doesn't.
When They Cry does call attention to itself as a work of literary fiction. But I would say that it does not do a lot of the more annoying meta things that postmodernism might do. In general, though, like the general vibe I would give for this series is it wants you to give a shit about something. And it's going to try everything it can to do that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
In various ways, the different parts of When They Cry, because if it is defined into several full self-contained fictions, is that it's various ways telling you that you should pay attention. You should care about what's happening. You should be thinking about what's happening.
Yeah, you should care about your friends. You should care about your culture. You should care about people.
Care about finding out what's right and doing it, being right by yourself, all those things.
You should care about the truth, but not to the extent that it causes harm to others. It wants you to care about people. Let's be clear, though. There's also a bit of a trend in the When They Cry community trying to say, oh, it's this wonderful story about love and friendship and all that. No. These stories are violent and dig into some really traumatic stuff. Every single episode of this series will have an explicit rating and we'll have some kind of warning at the start.
Within the multiple stories, we'll be giving content warnings for concepts such as self-harm, depression, gender identity, bullying, abuse, all these and more. Child abuse, extreme child abuse to the point from a viewpoint of helplessness, all these and more are all parts of this. So
yeah,
we will take this seriously, even as we are being a little bit silly.
Yeah, when I try to pitch this series to people, the phrase I use is this series has all the content warnings.
And the fact that we want to spend this much time talking about it, we think it's important to address that material head on. So we're going to try our best to not avoid it.
Yeah. To add a little bit more, I tend to put a division between stories that have dark themes and stories that just want dark themes. You're no point pizza cutters. And When They Cry definitely never falls into just trying to be that edgy, disturbingness to unsettle you. Everything in their stories matters.
The way that I put that sort of thing is that there's a difference between using dark themes and being trauma porn. Mm-hmm. And When They Cry is very much not trauma porn.
Yeah. There are characters in this series that, all throughout it, every time we like really get into the interior of them, I'm like, whoa, I feel seen in ways I've never felt seen before by an author. And like digs into some very traumatic stuff, but it also does have a lot of hope in it too. So I hope that's what we can get across about it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of spots in all of these works where it's just like, wow, that's extremely real writing.
But speaking of the author, I think it'd be a good time to start going into the history of it, because I think we've definitely
started
well the intro ground, without a doubt.
Sure. So let's talk about Ryukishi 7. And a lot of this is like information that we've found on various wikis and other places. Ryukishi 07 is the pen name of an otherwise anonymous but still public author. Like, he makes in-person appearances. He is a 40-something Japanese man who has worked as a social worker in the past, does not reveal his name to pretty much anyone.
Apparently he's known to be 49, though.
His pen name derives from Ryukishi, which means dragoon, literally dragon knight. And 07 is a Goro Awase, or playing with numbers, for Leta, a character from Final Fantasy V.
Yeah, Goro Awase is kind of hard on me because it's apparently so many numbers have syllable meanings that you can just kind of make words and names out of all sorts of numbers.
Yeah, it's essentially a kind of verbal numerology.
It's often used for like mnemonics and things like that in Japanese.
But as you said, it's for Leta, the character from Final Fantasy V.
Yep, I'm guessing that's probably his favorite Final Fantasy character.
One of his first characters, Rena, not only has a name of that, he originally drew her in a rather, let's say, I would describe it as cosplayish version of the Dragon Knight outfits, which he then reused as costumes in several of the series. Like, it actually goes to the Angel Mort.
Yep. Huh. We'll be able to talk about Angel Mort a little bit later in the series.
So one of the first things he did, he was a Final Fantasy fanboy. That's just
great. Yeah. Yes. Ryukishi founded a self-publishing novel studio called Seventh Expansion, which is pretty much staffed by him, a few friends, some programmers, and a team of composers led by Dai.
Yeah. Like, at least one of his brothers is part of it. It's very much a closed circle that put it together.
This is kind of just like coming from his mouth, and I don't know how much Ryukishi just like says shit to troll people at conferences and stuff like that. But when I went to Ryukishi's panel at SakuraCon back in, I want to say, 2019... Yeah, it was 2019. That was the year that we also got Kikoniya When They Cry. But yeah, Ryukishi was basically said that after a few episodes of Higurashi had been released, Dai came up to him and said, "I love your stuff. Your music is terrible. Let me make good music for you."
He was using public domain music in Higurashi, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Royalty-free public stuff, the type that people publish deliberately to go into like sound banks.
Yeah, like very, very generic sounding stuff. And you can still find people that want to patch in the older stuff. I don't like the older songs, with like one major exception, and that's it. Like the newer songs, I think, are way better that they've patched in recently.
But yeah, and the music in general has become a big part of it. So,
yep.
And it's so Dai and those who came after him succeeded amazingly.
Yeah. Umineko in specific has some of the most amazing music work that I can think of in a video game.
I'm not going to shortchange Higurashi here either, especially once we get into the second half of Higurashi. Like, there is some music in all of When They Cry that I'm just like amazed at how, and it's also pretty diverse overall. Like, Dai tends to do very piano-heavy themes, You'll find some composers that focus more on like synth. Some like M. Zaki has a very jazzy style. They bring in guest composers like ZTS. Yeah, ZTS is a guest composer that they bring in for Umineko, who does a lot of like really like baroque.
Epic is my favorite rock. Word
yeah,
for theirs.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
I laugh and say that some of Umineko's more dramatic stuff has the flavor I describe as nightcore harpsichord.
That sounds about right. So When They Cry first started in 2002 with the release of a single chapter at Comiket.
This is my reading about this, the story, the wiki information. This is just the most wonderfully ghetto sounding start that something.
Yeah, ever. From what I understand, he literally was burning like hand burned CDs with homemade jewel cases out of a single man stand at Comiket.
Yep.
And he wasn't even just selling them. He was slipping them in as prizes with like cards and artwork he was selling. And he would just say, like, oh, that's an accident, but why don't you try it? Something like that.
Yeah. Like,
it's just so wonderfully from the base of things.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those stories where a good story will find its way into people's minds.
And also, you got to keep in mind what Comiket is. It is the biggest fan published works convention in Japan. It happens twice a year. A lot of porn is sold there.
It's a doujin convention.
Yeah, fanfic of all kinds, including erotic.
I think we missed. Did we mention it was he's literally selling it for 100 yen each?
So you got to keep in mind, like, when Ryukishi was first making the series, that's part of the audience that he was selling to, is the people that go to Comiket.
And Higurashi is essentially his breakout hit. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of got to keep that in mind when we're reading it. So, you know, Higurashi can be a little bit rough around the edges because it's his first big work.
Yeah, the prototype for it was called a story called Hinamizawa Bus Stop, which, as I recall, like has a older version of Rika and Mion as the main characters, I think I've read.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lost version before Bus Stop that he literally, like, the data got wiped one day. I believe Bus Stop was close to being a stage play script that was originally rejected. That's one of those ones that, well, it exists. It really is just a prototype. Mm-hmm. Like, I believe it had Rika, Mion, several other characters, but like characters that weren't being, they're no longer used. So,
yeah. So Higurashi came out like came out with Comiket from 2002 to 2006. He had to skip a few years, just like he was bogged down with work and couldn't work on it. Because, again, this was like a side thing that he was working on.
But did he really just see how well it did? By the time he was he had gotten to the, I want to say, Himatsubushi is which arc again? The fourth?
That's the fourth.
Yeah, by then he was literally selling like 2,000 copies of Comiket selling out. So it actually really caught on like fire. Mm-hmm. Again, of course, all I've raised is wiki, so we're hoping that this accurate his take as written.
The series didn't make it westward until much, much, much later in its history. And in fact, like, we didn't have the original 8 episodes of Higurashi fully translated in English until a couple years ago. Like, what, 2020 is when they had it? 2021?
I feel like it was. I feel like you're a little too late there. I don't remember when Manga Gamer was.
The Manga Gamer release of episode 8.
May 14, 2020, huh?
Yeah. I was going to say, because we'll get to this later, but John had me go through Higurashi, and by the time I had gotten to chapter 8, the VN was not released, and so I had to watch the anime with him for it.
Yeah. Oof. Not a great experience. When we got his roommate, Clay, to go through it, we were able to read the visual novel version.
Now, the anime of Higurashi was one of the most infamous elements, at least that I knew about.
It's also the reason why the series even has a Western fan base to begin with, and I think we have to give it some credit for that.
The anime is, to not go too deep in it, is a deeply shortened series, basically because the graphic, the visual novel is very big, very granular and full of small important details.
It's a book.
Yeah, the anime cut it down heavily and kind of favored towards all the horror elements of a story that I would call a drama horror mystery. So it kind of cut 2/3 of the genres out, or at least down
heavily. Well, and also don't forget the big thing that the anime cuts out, the slice of life stuff.
Yeah.
The anime still tries to get some of that Fun with Friends vibes, but like it cuts out the when it like is going to do cuts, the thing that it cuts first is club games. And for that's actually going to be my big reason for why I don't think you should watch the anime, is it doesn't give you enough time with the characters before scary shit starts happening.
We'll get to this when we discuss it, the actual works, but I kind of feel like the anime is kind of infamous because it focuses too much on the little murder girls, basically.
Yeah.
Studio Dean got really into crazy faces and put together kind of an anime just based on that, as being as distorted and crazy as possible, but by focusing on those parts.
And it unfortunately becomes completely unsustainable, which is why Umineko didn't get a second season. Some would say it didn't get a first season, but I'm going to be acknowledging the first season of the anime for this podcast.
I mean, we've been kind of going interchangeably between the stories, but it's just worth kind of delineating. Yeah. The original Higurashi being a term for a type of cicada. So when the cicadas cry.
Yeah, it's a cicada that mostly chirps in the evening rather than like the more like cicada sound that you'd probably associate with in the summer. These are sort of a more melancholy cry that come at twilight.
Yeah. So Higurashi is a story about a small town and the strange past, dark secret. Because of that, it has that small town friendliness. It's about young kids living in it. Mm-hmm. After that comes Umineko, which refers to seagulls.
Yep. Specifically a black tipped wing seagull.
Umineko is an Agatha Christie style setting, a rich mm-hmm. family on an island that becomes a closed circle and something horrible happens there. Because of that, it's a much more Baroque fantastical story, and it cuts in much heavier magical elements as part of its storytelling. Or does it? That's the metafictional question. And because of that, Umineko, which is much more complex and it has a larger cast, the anime almost immediately collapses under its own weight.
There's also manga versions for both Higurashi and Umineko. I think the manga for the first chapter of Higurashi, which is all I've read so far, is better than the anime, but still not as good as the visual novel. So jury's still out on how much you should read of them.
I think the problem that we have with both the anime and the manga to certain extents is that we'll see from reading the visual novel, but a big part of the visual novel is the viewpoint character's interiority. We listen in on the viewpoint character's thoughts a lot, and you can't really do that in an anime or a manga.
You can in a manga, much more than you can in an anime, I'd say. Because, like, the thing about comics that's really nice is it is able to capture these moments where you can have a lot of thoughts flying around.
Narration.
Yeah, you can get, like, narration and thoughts that would, like, fill up a whole lot of just, like, we can't just have a character standing gawk-eyed still in animation. We have to have the characters moving.
There's also mentioned briefly there's the curious case of the third series, Kikonia, which refers to storks, and I believe is like the Latin name for a stork.
Yeah, well, Cyconia is supposed to be the Greek word for stork. Ryukishi did not know how to actually pronounce it, so the name is Kikonia.
yeah, so that has one episode released, I want to say 2019. We expected, I believe, was going to be four episodes four. As opposed to eight.
He said four this time.
Yeah, it's been in so far as of this recording, the second episode has not been released, nor has been any word for it. A lot of details, including the pandemic, have delayed. So,
yeah, the pandemic delayed it, not only because the pandemic delayed everything and the pandemic is still technically going on, people, come on, but also specific events in the manuscript that Ryukishi was working on apparently eerily paralleled the pandemic and yeah. Other things that were happening in 2020. So Ryukishi was just like, I need to not work on this right now.
Yeah.
Which fair.
Kikonia was a very cyberpunk sci-fi style with some very, very transhuman elements. So we're definitely still looking forward to see what happens of it, because it's so very different.
One other thing that we should mention as well is that part of the reason that Kikonia has still been delayed as well is that after the pandemic started, we found out that Ryukishi got asked by Konami to follow Guillermo del Toro's and Hideo Kojima's act and be the writer for the new Silent Hill game, Silent Hill F.
Mm-hmm. And it's a Silent Hill game that's going to be set in a Japanese setting, which probably will work pretty well, given how Ryukishi is very good at that setting. One last thing I want to talk about for Ryukishi's writing style, like why I think that'll work really well for Silent Hill and just in general, in the course of researching this podcast, I went down this rabbit hole based on a one-off line in one of the Higurashi chapters into the works of Seishi Yokomizo, a mystery author that mostly wrote around the post-war era of Japan. And I was astonished to find Ryukishi's general writing style and a lot of his narrative themes and the kinds of mysteries that he writes are extremely close to the Kindaishi novels that Yokomizo writes. For a while, I've actually been kind of like iffy on a lot of the neo-orthodox Japanese mystery writing. If you want to read some good Japanese mysteries, read probably Village of the Eight Graves is one of the better ones. All three of them are very close to, are closer to Umineko than Higurashi, I'd say. Village of the Eight Graves is the one that's the closest to both Higurashi and Umineko. So try, if you like When They Cry and you want to check out some good Japanese mystery, read that one. Anyway, and also the reason why I like to describe these as blood and tear-soaked tragedies is because Kindaishi novels often describe their own proceedings as blood-soaked tragedies, and Ryukishi likes to add people crying to things.
I also believe that Silent Hill F will turn out pretty well simply because Higurashi is a very similar setting. It's a it has a kind of country village out in the mountains of Japan with a very Shinto flavored religious thing going on that may have a metaphysical connection to what goes on in the story. I like Ryukishi as an author because I think he is a master of playing with your expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's very important in any kind of horror work. Oh, yeah. And in fact, I feel like the best way to describe Higurashi in general is to say that it's a deconstruction of slice of life and dating sim tropes that were popular at the time that he wrote
actually,
it.
Actually, I do want to, like, so Ryukishi was specifically, like, referring to in the general style of Higurashi is the works of key visual arts. So the whole idea of key visual arts is that they do what is called nakige, or games that make you cry. And they will build up a story around a character, and then there'll be a turning point, and then everything from there is going to be sad about that character. And what Ryukishi wanted to do is do that same thing with Higurashi, where he would take a character and build up a story around that character, and then at a turning point, everything about that character becomes scary.
Higurashi is taking these tropes around slice of life and to some extent dating sims that were popular in the
early
2000s and late 90s and tell a very different kind of story with them, specifically telling a psychological horror.
The reason why I wanted to like bring it up as specifically key visual arts rather than is because I've also come to learn that the term dating sim should probably be applied to something else that like visual novels and dating sims are actually a bit further apart than you might think. It's also important to bring up in the context of what a lot of people in the West tend to think of visual novels as. The quintessential dating sim is Tokimeki Memorial, which is a sim. It is a full-on, like, RPG-esque, systems-driven game about dating women. And the character that is on the box art of Tokimeki Memorial, Tim Rogers, my favorite video game critic, described as the hardest final boss in all of video games. But that's what happens when you get a dating sim made by these same people that at the time were making freaking Metal Gear Solid and Castlevania Symphony of the Night. So
that is a kind of crazy factoid.
So I tend to think of dating sims and visual novels very differently, where visual novels are more about like we have this big arc with maybe branching story paths, but the focus is on like delivering a full on narrative, whereas the point of a dating sim is to deliver the like a bit more sim like elements to it, like make it a bit more systems driven.
Got it.
So now when you get a lot of visual novels coming out from Western developers, they tend to go, oh, we're not one of those dating sims. We're going to be one of these anti-dating sims. And it is extremely boring to see this so many times. And just like they're telling the exact same joke over and over, and it's never fucking funny. Make me like either make a real ass dating sim, because I would play the shit out of that. That sounds great. Or take the visual novel format seriously, please. Those are the two things I want to see out of you. Shut up, Western game devs. Sorry, so, I got on a rant there. Let's talk about how we got into When They Cry.
Well, actually, do we want to talk a little bit about things like, or do we want to save this for Umineko? Talk about like the story of Witch Hunt and how.
Honestly, we've been so deep in the details here. I think now we're getting to stuff to be best.
Yeah, we've gone off track a little bit. One real thing is that Umineko's visual novel started in 2007. The fan translation became the official localization by Ryukishi, and it's kind of important because that's kind of ties into how Jared and I got into, like, really into When They Cry. So,
got it.
Let's get into that. So, like, I was president of an anime club back in 2006, 2007, and I watched a shit ton of anime at the time, in and out of club. And also, all of my friends from the anime club were women. And so when I randomly decided to start watching Higurashi, I became a bit paranoid of said female friends. Just like, nothing serious, of course, but it just was kind of like, the anime centers things in such a way that just made me go, I'm like Keiichi right now. This is weird. it became an obsession for me. By the time Umineko came out, I became a visual novel sicko, and the first arc of the anime made me want more, and then I learned the animes were trash.
So yeah, as the case of many things here, including all the major projects, John talked me into it.
Yep.
I knew about the anime, I had seen clips of it, I was definitely a random AMV watcher at the time, so I come across weird elements there. So finally, John talks to me watching things, like synced with him online as they did for a lot of stuff. So I was watching it alone in my grandmother's house, and my family was all gone that evening on a summer evening.
That's the best time.
Yeah. Weirdly, I started Umineko before John. That's not really sure how that happened. It happens more often with video games, but between my focus and the fact that he tends to the what's coming out faster than me, but well, I kind of faded out of it a few arcs in. It was years later if I go back and complete it. And I still, this is the first viewing of the full Higurashi visual.
And Matt?
So for me, after I became closer friends with John, he worked on me for a few months in order to get me to read When They Cry.
Yep.
And, you know, I had taken a few recommendations from him so far, and I had developed a trust in his media tastes. So it took a while, but he finally got me. And... And I would actually say that the process of him getting me to embark on this series and us reading it together is a bit of a microcosm for the creation and inspiration for this podcast in general. You know, I had never actually read any visual novels before that. It was a relatively unexplored kingdom of video games for me before this. And I'm still, you know, working on putting my feet more in this kind of genre as well. But I gotta say that I don't regret it at all. And, you know, he successfully got me to share in the brain rot of When They Cry, because I now consider it one of my favorite series of stories, if not my very favorite. I think it might be.
Excellent. So what do we want to get out of doing this series, apart from the fact that we all want to talk about one of our favorite stories?
The main thing is that we are planning to try a little bit of a restructuring of how our episodes go. Being off the cuff has really been working well through Kingdom Hearts, but this story kind of has a different form.
Yeah, it's just so much. It's got so much more meat on the bone that I don't think we can do this. I mean, these are monsters of works in general. I believe Higurashi, if I remember correctly, weighs in at around 600 to 7,000 words in all, and Umineko is over 1 million. We could not just do what we had been doing with Kingdom Hearts.
Higurashi, 1,111,705. Umineko, 1,152,480.
Oh, I was wrong about that. I mean,
they did a complete from a Reddit post, but still the best thing I got.
So, yeah. Real quick, how many words is War and Peace?
It's under 1 million, isn't it?
587,287.
You cheated.
Of course I did. I'm not going to guess.
I'm just asking for like a specific real answer here. Yeah, I was asking for a real answer. You said 570,000?
Yeah, that's first result on Google. It comes from Word Counter, the website.
Okay, that's another really long work of fiction.
The Wheel of Time.
How many words is the total Wheel of Time series?
By the way, the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy, 576,000. That's including The Hobbits.
Okay, so all of the Wheel of Time, which is quite a bit, 15 books, is 4.4 million words.
That's 15 books. We're doing 16 books here.
Those 16 books are 2 million.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Don't worry. We're going to get into something that's going to be way longer than freaking Wheel of Time soon. Well, not soon. We got a whole lot of When They Cry to get through before that.
Oh, yeah. So the goal here is, because these are so much like a book, we're trying to transition even further to the book club style.
Yeah. So like, we're going to do like a brief summary of the section that we're talking about, and then we'll go to a broader discussion format. We'll still have some riffing, but like, it's not going to be like the tell you the story again and riff on it anymore. Please read along with us and try and join us in the discussion, because that's where the real fun of the game lies.
In fact, if I remember correctly, doesn't Rikishi say that the way that you play his games is by discussing them with others?
That is correct. In a way, we're playing the game when we make this podcast. I love it. And by the way, if that made you think that a certain mind virus that has infected you caused you to lose some game, you have already won the game. You don't need to play anymore.
Remember,
you are free.
Yeah, so we're coming here to enjoy a tale, and you can enjoy a tale twice.
Oh, much. We're going to start with a pace of 3 visual novel chapters per episode and see how that goes as the works get longer.
To clarify, that's the individual chapters within the novels. Like, Higurashi has eight volumes with multiple chapters each. Like, we're not going to be reading 3/8 of Higurashi per chapter.
And also, we're going to cap each entry with what we would like to call a godcast that'll cover how the work was adapted and also discusses some very spoilery things, because we've already played or seen the series in some way, shape, or form. We know what's going on, and we'll have a very hard time not talking about that. So this is where we're going to put that.
The godcast is going to be essentially discussing these works from the perspective of somebody who already knows all the truths revealed thus far in the entire series.
Yep. These will be replacing the completionist episodes from Kingdom Hearts. I don't know how popular those ended up being, but
I don't know how you can do completionism on these anyways.
Want to know what I'm doing for completionism?
Sure.
I am playing through each story as many times as it's been adapted. So I'm first doing the visual novel, then I'm doing the anime, then I'm doing the manga. Actually, no, I think I'm doing the manga first, then the anime. That's the order I'm doing it. I'm doing it the manga, then the anime, and then I'm going through the visual novel again with the console sprites and voice acting.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I'm...
Yeah.
My goal is, I have a housemate who doesn't know Higurashi at all. I showed him a large chunk of Danganronpa through the excellent Let's Play of a Sunwin Cho and his friend Jay. Mm-hmm. So watching through that, he liked those. So my idea is, if I can get him watching Higurashi, whether through me like beaming up, I can peer that, I can get the reactions of a complete unaware.
Excellent.
And someone who, while nerdy, isn't exactly the otaku style nerdy, so it kind of gives a different perspective as well.
Fantastic. Mm. If you can get that to work, I would love it.
It's kind of fingers crossed still. It's just a matter of figuring out if we can get time together, like with our schedules overlapping, get through without like annoying my brother with watching, like taking the TV for hours and hours of time kind of sucks. Mm-hmm.
John and myself actually in the past got one of my roommates to go through Higurashi and Umineko with us. And
I didn't fully join for all the read-throughs until we went through chapter 8. I was only just sort of like dropping in and out every now and then, but I was there the entire time with Umineko because I can't help myself.
And yeah, it's really fun to watch people go through these. And
oh, yeah.
One of the reasons that we want to do this is that hopefully we'd like to spark people discussing these things with us on our podcast chats or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. We want to Sherpa more people into enjoying these series and have a way to discuss them with others.
We're also going to have mini logs after each entry in the series that we kind of feel pair well with the general discussion beforehand. So when we were doing the Kingdom Hearts series, the mini logs were just kind of an experiment of
other topics that we enjoyed.
Yeah. As we went along, I kind of liked the idea of pairing mini logs with the works proper. And so in my view, the mini logs are going to be less optional this time around. So hopefully you will listen to those as well. And hopefully we'll be able to make it so that they're a lot more accessible as well. But we're still going to talk about some weird ass stuff.
Oh, yeah. we're throwing around random active manga, video games, extra like weird topics.
Yeah.
Anything could really show up.
You'll probably see a pattern in the sort of things that we like, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm
not going to deny that.
There's probably going to be a lot more anime and manga that pair with Higurashi because, of course, it's a work of it's a visual novel that like is very tangential to anime and manga.
It's based on a lot of anime and manga tropes, you know?
Yeah. That being said, I'm not going to recommend anything that I do not like 100% put my seal of quality on. I think people should watch this or read this. No guilty pleasure type reads or anything like that. No, it's going to be stuff that I'm like, this is actually really good and people need to pay attention to it.
I don't know. There's some guilty pleasures that I have that I still get 100% behind, but
yeah,
I guess there's a difference between some of those.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be recommending anything ecchi is what I'll say. At least not that like that's the specific goal of it.
It's just not where you tend to find yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why do we want to discuss it? The series in general, I think we've touched on this a little bit already, but at least for me, my general view, and this is going to sound extremely high-minded and pretentious, but if everyone in the world read and understood When They Cry, I think the world would be a better place. That's my high-level view of this series. So take it what you will.
Me, I'm not going to say that. I like discussing fiction with complexity, not like the story is very complex. Well, it is, but I like that when you get deeper and deeper layers to whichever way you want to go.
For me, I feel that When They Cry is one of the silver bullets that I can use for our video games art debate. It's really one of those things that I would put next to any piece of literary fiction that literary fiction type snobs would exalt and say, this has a place next to this.
So I'm going to say, one, I don't actually think of When They Cry as a video game.
that's just
my own like general way of thinking. Like if When They Cry, if I thought of it as a video game, it would be above Final Fantasy XIV as my favorite game. But I don't think of it like that.
That's the thing, is that it's in some definitions it's a video game, but the thing is that it's not really a game because there's no choices.
I mean, I don't think you need choices to be a game. More the vibe, the feel. It's a, I know it when I see it. We're asking you to read a book here, people.
Yes.
That's one of the biggest barriers to entry here is people have a very hard time when you tell them to read something, especially nerdier people. Like modern nerds, they want to get their media fast and they want to get their media like directly. They don't want to like take the time to slow down and enjoy it. So I'm going to say up front, we are asking you to read. Please read. Reading is the best thing you can do for your brain. When They Cry has a bit of a lower barrier to entry than like your typical book, because there's still going to be pictures and music and that kind of thing. But it is very wordy. It's very long. Take the time to sink in and live in it, because that is when you will like really like feel it working, is my opinion.
Yeah, it's a very slow burn type of story in a lot of ways. And, you know, like we'll get to this when we start discussing the first chapter, but when you have all of this slice of life stuff, some people are just kind of like rankling at it, like get to the exciting stuff. But I feel that the exciting stuff wouldn't hit as hard if you didn't have all of this slice of life stuff and when normalcy breaks, you feel it. It's a punch to the gut. And that's because of that slow pace.
The other thing I'm going to say is that the slice of life stuff, it is actually some of the most interesting parts when you go back on reread. Like in Higurashi, there's so many like subtle character work going on in the slice of life, especially the game sections, that surprises me every time I go back to it. and in Umineko, all the stuff that is just like building the family before the mystery starts happening is like some of the best character writing I think I've ever seen.
Like, yeah. I mean, in both Higurashi and Umineko, I feel you get attached to the characters very quickly. And all of the characters have a lot of really excellent characterization. And they're all complex characters that have more to them than first meets the eye. And it's really a joy to go through these series and get to know the characters.
Let's talk about a few other barriers to entry, though. So, as we alluded to before, the series has a bit of a reputation. First of all, as being all about, like, the violence due to the reputation of the anime. But also, Higurashi in particular, because it was being sold at Comiket to regular Comiket attendees. Yeah, it is a bit horny.
It has a bit of horniness in it, but no more than, like, say, your average Stephen King novel that that focuses on bad things happening to young people. You know what I mean?
Jared, can you vet that statement?
Sorry, what? I literally am trying to the statement of which one again?
About the Stephen King novels, about it not being any worse than, you know, sorts of novels that you see in the West. I mean, maybe it's a little bit more horny than that, but not by much.
Angel Morty. I'm sorry, Angel Morty.
King is weird.
Yeah.
Stephen King is very unusual. He tends to, like, walk in and out of strange topics. Like, I'm never quite sure, like, what his aim tends to be. I do like Stephen King. He's a very, I like him as a person. I like a lot of his work, but it is very strange.
He has a stream of consciousness type of writing style in some ways.
Extremely.
The reason why I kind of like have a hard time believing that is I doubt that Stephen King puts a Hooters in every chapter of
That's true.
No, he will just very randomly have. I don't really want to go. He's like, he'll throw in sex scenes that sometimes are disturbing, sometimes make no sense, and sometimes just I don't.
Okay. So, yeah. Angel Mort, and also just like some of the more teenage humor, I will say, can turn people off. And it is important to note that, at the least in the case of the teenage humor, I think it actually works coming from the characters that it does, because it's...
They're teenagers.
They're teenagers, and it never goes too far. It doesn't hit the point where I would say, this is way too much, this is sexualizing minors. It does not do that. Angel Mort sexualizes minors, and that's a problem.
The thing is that, like, I think a lot of the time the author tries to be above that, the audience in that case, but every so often he kind of descends into having his cake and eating it too. But once we get into Umineko instead of Higurashi, I think that complaint goes away.
Umineko has some horny character designs, especially when you get into certain sets of characters, but the writing itself is less horny. Apart from a few scenes that are interestingly written. but I will say, like, in general, it's way more literary on the whole in Umineko.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, Higurashi kind of has that kind of, you know, anime vibe that sometimes gets into kind of raunchy humor, more or less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And raunchy situations.
Another thing that's kind of a barrier is the art style. How would you describe a typical Ryukishi sprite?
My personal reaction to the Ryukishi sprites is that I love them and they're charming, but he has can't draw hands syndrome really badly.
Mm-hmm. He draws giant hands.
Yeah. Basically, I feel like his faces are brilliant. Like, his faces are everything that I love about 90s anime. But the rest of the bodies are a little bit, let's just call them super deformed.
Part of the designs of Higurashi are meant to clearly evoke the style of Ki visual arts, which leans very heavily into the Moe art style. will generally like make girls seem a lot more cutesy, make the eyes bigger, the noses and mouths smaller, accentuate the cuteness of the characters. That starts being a bit less prevalent in Umineko, where you have, oh, I would say most of the cast as adults. Some of them are old adults.
Umineko, actually, the author significantly leveled up his art skills for it, even though he still can't draw hands.
He can actually start draw hands a little bit by the time we get to Kikania. But in general, like, his fashion sense is actually extremely strong.
Yeah, the costume designs are all great.
His character design sense on the whole, I think, is extremely good. It's just like he is not a I'm going to say professional artist. He is a doujin artist. So
there are, in fact, redone sprites that are default in the Manga Gamer release of Higurashi When They Cry, which I do not like.
The Steam sprites are not good. They're unusual. So Ryukishi is a doujin artist. He's self-published. He does his own like fan art type stuff. The art for the Steam release, I swear, was done by a porn artist. It is.
I mean, the characters are so cut.
The designs are much hornier than the typical Ryukishi designs are.
That's not really my complaint. I just feel like they're general moe blobs that don't have the personalities of the original.
That's part of it, yeah. If you want good upgraded sprites, there is a mod called Seventh Mod that will give you the sprites that were used in the PlayStation 3 console version. And there's also a version of 7th Mod for Umineko as well, that, as in those sprites as well. Those sprites are actually pretty good. There's a few sprites that I still prefer the original character design of for Ryukishi due to some costume changes that I'm kind of like, why would you take that out? Why would you do that? Well, talking about why would be a spoiler, but just certain decisions that are made in the console sprites I don't agree with, but otherwise they are very well done. They don't, like, weirdly sexualize the characters in a way that concerns me. And so, like, I would consider 7th Mod to probably be the best way to experience it if you can't handle the classic Ryukishi sprites. If you can handle the classic Ryukishi sprites, they grow on you in a way that nothing else will.
I am an original sprites gang all the way.
Yep. Jared, you're using 7th Mod for this, right?
Yeah, basically. Oh, I see the old sprites and I recognize ones from Umineko and that. Honestly, I'm perfectly good using the console style ones. Though it is kind of amusing since there's shortcut buttons for switching between them randomly to see what it looks like.
Yep. Yeah, there are some console sprites that I'm just like, oh, these are so good. Like Satoko is the best one. Rika looks a bit thin in the console sprite. That's just me, like, judging. We'll talk about that more in the actual series. So the final barrier that we kind of see is just, again, telling people to read a book, and not just read any book, read a visual novel, which has all kinds of connotations that come to mind when people talk about it. And so let me say right now, although it has content that is violent, that can be horrifying, scary, it is not sexual in any way. If you are of a mature enough state of mind to handle violence and scary stuff, you are able to enjoy this story.
You know, there's some people that I would probably not recommend this story to, but it all has to do with the content warnings rather than most of anything else.
Yeah. And again, we're going to give content warnings at the start of every episode based on whatever is going on inside of it. Because this is going to be a bit dark for quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
And with that, I think we've hit the end of the hype episode. I hope you all are excited. Next week, we begin our journey with beginning of Higurashi When They Cry Onukakishi. If you want to read along, we're going to cover up through chapter 3. So when you have a save file that says end of chapter 3, that's where to stop.
Basically, every time you hit, like, they say something called tips are added, that tends to be the end of a chapter.
Yeah, once you have hit your third batch of tips, that is the end of the next reading assignment. Yes, I'm calling them reading assignments, folks.
Well, we're going with a more hardcore book club format now, so.
Yeah, sounds good to me. But with that being said, I'm John.
I'm Jared.
And I'm Matt.
And remember, A good story is best enjoyed with friends. Thank you for listening to Backlog Dialogues. If you liked our show, please leave us a review that Rena would find cute. If you want to dig into our dark history, you can find our archives at www.backlogdialogues.com. Join the discussion on Twitter at Backlog Dialogues or on our Discord server. When They Cry and all associated properties are owned by 7th Expansion and Manga Gamer. Console versions by Intergram. Please support the official release.
Well, do you know what Whitney Houston's favorite coordination is?
I'm terrified.
And I... No,
that's terrible.
God, you are... You, that is extremely loud. Please don't do that again. That hurt me.
I had this... You can't do that one by text. You have to do it by voice.
You were holding on to that one, weren't you?
Yeah, for a couple days.
Wow. Just so you can hurt my ears.
Yes.